Although errors in diagnosis and management occur for various reasons, cognitive factors are the most common source of these errors in medicine. Although often unavoidable, recognizing the cognitive processes utilized in clinical decision-making and their shortcomings are the first step in mitigating some of these diagnostic errors. In this dialogue, Dr. Stephen Sciama and Dr. Jason B. Lee discuss how we can learn from errors in practice to better help our patients.
My name is Steve Sciama, and it's my pleasure to be in the presence of Jason Lee, Dr. Jason Lee, who has a number of titles. He's the professor of dermatology, the director of dermatopathology at Thomas Jefferson University, Department of Dermatology in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and also the residency and fellowship director. Jason, it's my pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, you have a very, very interesting topic, and obviously something that is really important, should be important to all of us who are taking care of patients, diagnostic delays in making the specific correct diagnosis and perhaps the incorrect diagnosis. And certainly we want to be able to be efficient, tell people what something is, and also avoid the errors that we all could make and don't want to make. So what got you interested in this? Because it's obviously very important. It's also fascinating to me.
I've been at the Academic Center for the last 20 years or so, and it's working with the residents and thinking about how they learn diagnoses and how they recognize the diseases that a seasoned clinician can come up with the diagnosis within a matter of seconds, whereas residents just beginning has a lot of trouble getting to the correct diagnosis, and thinking about what processes are involved in that novice clinician versus a seasoned clinician, I started thinking about, well, where did the cognitive process go wrong and what's an efficient way of thinking of making the correct diagnosis sort of spurred me to explore this topic.
Okay. All right. So if I'm a resident just starting out in dermatology, I don't even know what I don't know, which is the beginning.
Right. So what happens when you're just beginning, so you're in a different mode than compared to somebody who's been practicing for a while. You're basically in an analytic mode. It's a very slow, deliberate thinking process. Right. Whereas where a seasoned clinician or experienced or an expert clinician, it's recognized at an instant because he has this repertoire of illness scripts, or he goes through a pattern recognition that's done unconsciously. So whereas the resident is doing things consciously, the expert clinician is doing it at an unconscious level. But when you do that, there are potential errors that can be encountered, and the expert clinician has to be sort of aware of that. And sort of that's my interest in exploring what are those potential pitfalls in cognition. And so those are the topics that I sort of explored in my talks and trying to think of this topic.
Because I understand that when you're teaching a resident something, they have to know that a scaly eruption around the nose could be a number of different kinds of things. The most common one is seborrheic dermatitis, but it could be lots of things, variation of psoriasis. But the seasoned person is what you are focusing on. And it's fair, it's okay, because I think probably a lot of residents say, well, I'm seasoned at this point. It's when you short circuit and you say, oh, I know what that is. And you're saying be humble and be aware of the fact that you may not have considered something because you just kind of make this snap judgment.
Correct.
You think it's a learned judgment with a lot of thinking behind it that has just come naturally because you want to get to that flow state of like, I don't want to go through sebderm, I want to go through psoriasis, I don't want to go through lupus. But you have to be careful about making those respectfully submitted snap judgments.
Right, or it's also called jumping to conclusions or shotgun decisions.
Okay.
So they work for the most part for the experienced clinician, but there are times it doesn't work. I think it's important to understand when it doesn't work, and that's a topic I don't think has been explored in this era of quality of care and so on, and so I think it's a topic that'll come up more and more often.
All right, it's extremely important that we know when we make a decision, that it's a very learned decision.
Right.
And after a point, we might get kind of lackadaisical and say, well, that's what it is. I remember a chief resident of mine when I was first-year resident always said, Steve, all psoriasis is never the same. It may be in the same spot, elbows, maybe scaly, maybe white, maybe whatever, but look at it all the time and every time you see it, because it will humble you sometimes to say this is a psoriasiform lesion or a lichenoid region. And that really stuck with me forever. It was a humility to what we're seeing. It was taking a step back.
So you mentioned the word humility multiple times.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we want to be, because one of the repeat theme when you look at this literature is that the experienced clinician is overconfident, so that he is subject to what we call premature closure. He doesn't investigate enough. And so I think that's important to emphasize.
Right. I remember when I am seeing a patient or did see patients, I'm looking at them and you make this snap judgment.
Yeah.
You say, this is what it is. It's a contact dermatitis, it's oozing and sweeping, whatever. And then when I was taught to perhaps from someone like yourself, the same kind of thing, is that, wait a second, let me stop back. What else could it be?
Correct.
And I always used to go through that because I realized snap judgments are very efficient. They get you through the day, but you can make an error and you really don't want to make errors.
Right. So one of the most common mistakes is that you don't think of the diagnosis. You don't think of the alternative diagnosis.
It's not even
there. And I also give examples of how I made those mistakes as well. So An expert clinician has vast experience and he has this huge repertoire of illness scripts. When he sees a patient, he or she can match it and there's instantaneous judgment and decision and diagnosis is made. So we call that pattern recognition, intuition. I always thought intuition was something you're born with, but it's based on experience. Without experience, you can't have that correct intuition. So pattern, gut feeling, those are all based on past experiences. And then you're just recalling, it's just recognition, an instant level, where unconscious level, and it's coming up. But there are some biases, what we call misleading heuristics, that you can go awry from the correct diagnosis.
All right, so talk about the kinds of things that can get a seasoned physician into trouble, so to speak. And I don't want to use the word trouble like malpractice trouble, but trouble in the sense of you're in front of a bunch of residents and you say, oh, this is lupus or this is whatever. And then you realize you got to eat your words because it wasn't. You were a little bit too quick to make the diagnosis because you were in front of residents and situational kinds of things, I would imagine also. If there's someone very, very important, you want in front of you like a patient, maybe the chief of a department of another department, and you're in front of residents and you're the attending and you walk in and say, oh, this is such and such. And you made a quick decision because you were a little bit cocky or whatever.
And you gotta overconfident.
Overconfident, thank you. And all of a sudden you realize, ooh, why'd I do that?
Right.
So discuss the kinds of things that get us into a quick diagnosis, the wrong one, when we make an error.
Well, so I can recall one recent error where I go in and I see a patient and has relatively classic annual lesion of subacute lupus erythematosus. And I said, well, that's what it looks like. We'll confirm it by biopsy. It comes back interface dermatitis, so classic subacute lupus erythematosus. And then I worked with a resident, and she was our chief resident, who suggested, well, why can't it be drug-induced? And I said, well, it could be, but it's classic annual lesions, sort of the right distribution. And I told her, every time I stop any drugs, I've never discovered the drug was the cause. And so I told her, well, let's just treat. We'll start mycophenolate mofetil and see what happens in a couple of months. Well, lo and behold, the patient comes back completely clear in 2 months. And I say, well, mycophenolate mofetil usually doesn't work that fast and that great. And then basically the patient told me, we stopped this X medication and it all went away instantaneously. So again, I was humbled. And in retrospect, one, it's one of those things called representative heuristic, where I basically looked at the patient and in my mind, that's a classic presentation, at least what I thought was a classic presentation of subacute lupus erythematosus. And then the other thing I was subject to was what's called availability heuristics, in the sense that every time I stop medications, it never works. The patient still continues to have the eruption. So the experience has been, what's fresh in my mind is that stopping medication doesn't work. And so what happened is that when I go back and look at the patient, well, the patient was a little older than usual in the 70s and 80s for the disease.
Less common.
Okay. And then it was more widespread. It was on the legs. Now, I've seen widespread subacute lupus erythematosus, but it'd be unusual to have from down to the legs and ankles. And so there are some clues where I should have said, pause, but I didn't pause. So in psychology, they talk about system one and system two way of thinking. System one is that unconscious, rapid fire recognition. System two is the conscious reasoning, where it puts on the brakes to make sure whether it's that presentation, the system one, what it presents is either is accepted or rejected by system two, and I didn't appropriately apply the brakes at that point.
Yeah, there's an expression when I was thinking about what we'll be talking about. Someone has used this, and I there's a name to it, a physician's name, but it's just don't do something, stand there. As opposed to just don't stand there, do something. Don't just do something, stand there. Take a pause. You reminded
right.
me of that.
Yeah.
The other thing that's wonderful about being in a teaching institution with residents is they ask the why. Dr.
Right.
Lee, why do you think that? And they say, well, because of this, this, and this. And they say, well, it's extensive. Well, in my experience, I've never seen it that way. But then you say, you know what? Maybe it's a possibility. So they're
right.
there as our teachers, in a sense.
Right. So I did consider it. But again, one of the reasons I was overconfident of my judgment and sort of discounted her judgment.
Let me ask you a question. Taking it away from you being overconfident or whatever else, because you're a good guy and I know you're smart and all that kind of good stuff, is it, let's assume someone else is overconfident. How do you become less overconfident about that? In other words, how do you know it's happening so that you can say, you know what, let me take a step back. I may be the attending, I may be the professor of dermatology
right.
and dermatopathology at a great institution, but I'm still a person and I still can make an error. And how do you think that, or should it be part of what you, I think it should be, but how do you remember that on a regular basis every time you step into a room or every time you have a conversation
well,
with a
that's
patient?
A very good question, because the process I'm talking about, the system one in psychology, is done unconsciously. So how mm-hmm. do you consciously be aware of it?
And system one, again, remind us.
Is a unconscious rapid recognition. This is where pattern recognition, intuition, gut feeling all lies in based
okay.
on previous experience. And
okay.
that when you see something, we perceive something, that judgment is based instantaneously, and this is what all the expert clinicians use. So that's done unconsciously. So how do you consciously implement strategies to prevent some of the pitfalls that occurs unconsciously? And some people say they can't be done,
mm-hmm.
but all that you can do is to let them aware that
this may be happening.
The overconfidence, so that you are more cued to pause rather than just going with the initial impression.
Mm-hmm. And I, again, the word humility comes up to
Correct.
Say, I got to pause. I just don't have to do something. I should wait and think. And sometimes the pause is not a long pause, and it doesn't suggest that. In fact, the pause can be something like a professor does to say, "Woo, he's going into his really think mode here." So you have permission as a professor not to kind of spout forth something. And something is coming up now. The pressures of us seeing more patients, more and more patients in less and less time is becoming more and more common. That's when errors can occur. And that's when you think you want to rely on that quick system one thinking. This is what I believe it is. It's more like I'm more likely than not going to be correct. And therefore, I'm going to be getting in and out of rooms and everyone's going to like me.
Correct. So as I become more seasoned, I tend to rely on system one. And so one of the things that you're right, the pressures of seeing more patients, so seeing more patients, you're going to rely on system one and you're going to be prone to more of those errors.
Mm-hmm.
So idea is to see less, take care of yourself so that you're not tired and your moods are, you're not depressed and so on. So all those things come into play. And so the other thing that you need to be aware of, what we call affective influence on cognition, which is, for example, we don't want to take care of every kind of patient. So for example, I like pigmented lesions of the nail, but I don't like any other conditions. So when I see a patient with some syndrome of the nail, there's this reaction in me that unconsciously, it's a dislike or discomfort that probably results in cursory exams so that I may miss the diagnosis. So you have to be aware of those affective influences
okay.
as well.
I think that's very, very important. If you're not interested in something or you realize, oh, it's typically a complicated disease, you may make a quick diagnosis. And then just kind of say, well, we'll find out in a week or so when I use this high-potency topical steroid.
Correct.
Which is a cure for everything, or at
right.
least a control for everything. And then just get them in, get them out. But you haven't done them justice.
Correct.
And so you might admit that I typically don't like to see hair and nail problems. And when something comes up like that, you might actually say to the person, say, you know what, I'm going to give you hope. You're not going to go bald. Your nails are not going to become things. But I have someone who has even more expertise than I do, and I would prefer to do that. I know you've taken off from work to see one of us, but for the best care, I'm going to have you see Dr. So-and-so. I can make a special request that he see you sooner than later. I hope that's okay.
Yeah, so that's
I'm
a good
to be honest.
Yeah, that's a good way to handle those patients. There are certain diseases where I sort of consciously knew that I had this adverse reaction to it,
yeah.
and so I consciously made an effort to learn more about it and treat the diseases and seek advice and go to courses where I can become more comfortable with it. So I've done that as well.
Okay, so during the day, you might actually start to be more analytic about the patients that you're seeing and record the kinds of problems that you might have had making a diagnosis or where you might have gotten tripped up. so that the next week you might say, interesting, I'm going to do what Dr. Lee just suggested. There are problems with hair and nails that I have a bias against, and I'm not as complete. I want a short circuit, because again, if I give a high potency topical steroid, it's not going to make it worse, and it could conceivably make it better. But you haven't really given the patient the real, real time that they deserve to do this. And that's not fair, and that's not right.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Good. That's wonderful. What else can we do? What other kinds of biases might we have when we walk into a room? You mentioned also one's mood. I think you got to peek when you walk into every patient room.
Right.
They deserve your time. They deserve 100% of you.
Right. So you're not providing optimal care. You're distracted by other thoughts in your mind and so on. And so you really want to have an approach where you can be objective without any distracting moods and so on, so that, as you said, provide the most optimal care for the patient.
And be a good listener?
Be a good listener. And obviously, again, you mentioned that we're, you know, strained for time and we have to see a lot of patients. And so you have to appropriately cut off the patients and not do it. You have to individualize every patient encounter, obviously.
Yeah, what I've found is that, if I had to talk to a patient and they're going on, I might interrupt them saying, forgive me, I'd like to ask some specific questions if that's okay with you. So asking permission. But you have to have some lines so that you can actually direct the dance, which we have with every patient. It's a dance.
Yeah, it's a dance.
And you have to control it, because ultimately they want your information. But you don't want to do it crudely or rudely.
No.
And so those kinds of things come into all this also. So that you get the most important information, you slow yourself down, you realize where you are. And do you teach this to the residents? I mean, is there any part of it?
Well, that's the thing. That there's questions in the literature whether you can even teach this stuff. But I think the first thing is understand the cognitive process.
Okay.
Understand the different biases and where it occurs. And there's no robust data out there that all these strategies, there are lots of papers out there that it works and it decreased the diagnostic error rate. But what it will ultimately do in the end is humility will come into play. You realize you're overconfident and that the attitudes may adjust so that this topic will be important for further research and further exploration down the road.
Yeah, I think that this ought to be introduced into residencies in a formal way. And sometimes you can actually debrief. And I'm just thinking of this scenario. Dr. Lee, you walk into a room as the attending, and a resident is presenting the person to you and all the diagnostic information. You look at the patient for a moment, you make a diagnosis, and then you take care of the patient. And then the two of you walk out of the room with a number of who, the resident who is present, perhaps other residents who might have seen this, and you debrief what the resident said and how you already put that into a diagnosis. And then you say, here's my thinking, and here's where I stopped, because you said this.
Right.
What do you think about that, and have you done that?
So this is relatively a new exploration for me, so I am beginning to do that now as I begin to now assess how the residents are thinking, where they go wrong, and so I'm beginning to do that at the bedside after seeing the patients. And then the other thing that I sort of recommend everybody is to get some feedback. So when we make our diagnosis, we don't know whether we made the correct diagnosis. Often the patients go away and they never come back. We have no idea that you made the correct diagnosis. In a hospital setting, when I'm comfortable with the diagnosis that I made, if I don't get a feedback, again, I don't know. So you need to get a feedback both whether you were wrong and whether you were right, because you need that confirmatory positive feedback so that you understand that your thinking process was correct. Also, you need to also need to get a feedback from when you were wrong so that you can readjust. And one of the things about dermatology is easier to do that compared to other fields. So you have the disease in front of you, you can see it getting better, biopsies to confirm the diagnosis, and all those tools are available to you. Compared to other specialties, it's easier to get the feedback. But again, it requires conscious effort and a busy practice day. To get a follow-up on every one of these cases is difficult to do.
You can ask the patients to call you.
Yeah.
And I really mean that in quotes to the patient, looking at them in the eye, saying it's important for me to know that you're doing better. So summarize what we've been talking about, Jason. Give us some tips to say, okay, fine. Here's how we can decrease with the diagnostic delays that we have and also our errors, just to kind of wrap up what we've been talking about.
Most clinicians, including dermatologists, have little insight on the cognitive process and where the thinking goes wrong that leads to errors in diagnosis, when and why and hows of errors in diagnoses. So the first thing is to understand how our thinking occurs and when it goes awry.
Yes. Okay.
So the first thing is to understand how we think and where things go awry, and then look at some of the different strategies and tailor those strategies to yourself and understand your weaknesses and so on. So one of the things, you have to be open-minded for introspection. And so if you're not, this doesn't work. And so you need to be open-minded about reflective thinking, looking over your clinical reasoning. That will all help to minimize the errors in diagnosis.
A pinch of humility, too.
We talked about a pinch of humility as well.
Actually, I put in a spoonful of humility and all that kind of stuff. So would you think that this would be something that residents should be having in residency programs on a regular basis? Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing?
Or yeah, perhaps, I think so. As I do more of this stuff, I feel like it can be a formal didactic component of their training. And as you said, it can be done at the bedside now and going through the different, understand the different processes and actually teach the residents and interact with the residents. And I am sure the faculty will also learn a lot because they're going to make mistakes and they're going to learn from their mistakes as well as, you know, correcting the mistakes of the residents.
We're never stopping learning in our lives, and I think that's a humble kind of thing, and that's very, very important. Jason, great talking to you this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and your residents are lucky to have you.
Thank you.
The incorrect diagnosis of a patient's condition fuels inefficiency in healthcare, basically because inappropriate therapy is typically prescribed and leaves the patient insufficiently treated. 10 to 20% of medical errors can be attributed to diagnostic errors, and 40,000 to 80,000 U.S. hospital deaths result from misdiagnosis annually. Dr. Lee offered an analysis of the cognitive processes in clinical decision-making and where they frequently break down that leads to diagnostic errors. Dr. Lee opines that the science of measuring diagnostic errors and their harms are underdeveloped and understudied, and that physicians typically do not have personal insight into diagnostic errors. In fact, most physicians are biased toward overconfidence. Dr. Lee highlighted four different sources of diagnostic errors by physicians with varying levels of experience. They are no-fault error, knowledge deficit, affective influences, and cognitive bias. The no-fault error can be patient-related or system-related, like when dealing with a deceptive patient or when the wrong labs are entered into the patient's record. Knowledge deficit plays a very little role for the seasoned clinicians, but it plays a larger role for the novice physician or physician extender. Affective influences may be transitory and situational. For instance, fatigue, stress, and other health-related factors may be a burden on the physician, or the patient may be disagreeable. Finally, cognitive bias, which accounts for 75% of the diagnostic errors. Heuristics are mental shortcuts that allow people to solve problems and make judgments efficiently in everyday life. They dominate our day-to-day clinical reasoning and are practical and effective, but sometimes lead to cognitive errors in complex environments. More than 100 biases affecting clinical decision-making have been described, and many medical disciplines acknowledge their pervasive influence on our thinking. Such biased reasoning has thought to be associated with System 1 or non-analytic pattern recognition thinking. However, diagnostic errors are not simply a consequence of cognitive biases or over-reliance on one kind of thinking. They result from multiple causes and are associated with both analytical and non-analytical reasoning. There is an accumulation of evidence that interventions directed at specifically encouraging both analytical and non-analytical reasoning may result in small but consistent improvements in accuracy. Dr. Lee stated that training and experience in critical thinking and striving for humility may help ameliorate these problems. His recommendations to minimize diagnostic errors include 1. Optimizing the environment. For example, high patient volume leads to more diagnostic errors. 2. Take care of yourself. Minimize fatigue, sleep deprivation, and stress. Burnout is more common among physicians than among any other U.S. workers. Physicians and specialties at the front line of care seem to be at the greatest risk. Well-being is important in any decision-making process. 3. Seek feedback. This offers a chance to recalibrate with new insight. And 4. Self-awareness is important. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Dialogues in Dermatology. Next month, we look forward to 3 new dialogues. Remember to download the Dialogues in Dermatology app for your smartphone. We also want you to join us on Facebook for previews, educational info, and fun. This has been Terry Cronin with Dialogues in Dermatology. Stay passionate about dermatology and keep up all the great work you're doing on behalf of your patients. I'm proud of your continued commitment to quality CME. Have another great month.